a night owl, that's for sure. Graham was a look. Our working styles were quite different. I was as having been a journalist. Well, he was a journalist as well, I suppose. But I mean, I typed and I handwrote. Graham dictated. So Graham's typical working style was to get one of the tireless, energetic executive staff from the secretarial room down at the end there, and he would pace and smoke and produce this liquid prose.
Or was you not inside that little office shared by the two of you?
No. He would head off, or he would well, it was different in the new Parliament House. In the old Parliament House, he would dictate in the kind of far corner of the PMO, there was a room that was allocated for the secretary of the department. And apparently Yeend had used that. I arrived after Yeend when Codd was the secretary. Codd rarely used that. So there was, amazingly enough, there was space, and that had a little anteroom. And I can remember Graham dictating there. This is early days of screen-based technology. So, you know, he would look over the shoulder of the typist as she's writing up and point to emendations on the screen and so forth. So he was much more an oral person, very... He would dictate slowly, it must be said, and certainly if it was late at night, I believe there were times when the secretary fell asleep, poised over her shorthand pen, waiting for the next word to emerge. But when it emerged, it was always good. And I was more daytime, as I say, typing and handwritten and much more kind of paper-based, I guess. Mm. I had a young family at that stage as well, so... I tried to make my working life, I tried to get some balance in my working life, probably not very successfully.
Mm. Working for the Prime Minister, how did you see that relationship in practice?
Mm. Well, he was Bob Hawke was simply an excellent guy to work for. I look back on it with a lot of... I mean, it was difficult, but there was never a moment's doubt that this was all worthwhile, that it was constructive, that it was a good thing to be doing. And so there were times, so, you know, I would take my speech draft into him and, you know, you're sitting in the Prime Minister's office with the Prime Minister at his desk, reading your work, puffing on his cigar and occasionally scribbling something on it. And you're aware that there's just this whole world outside of other stuff that he could be doing and he's got to get to do. But here's, you know, however long it took, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, whatever, where he's focused on your work. And you had his absolute attention. So I used to make the metaphor of a lighthouse. You know, it was like the lighthouse sweeping round, sweeping round, sweeping round. But when it's focused on you, it's focused on you. And, you know, so whilst I never said I was close to Hawke, I wasn't one of his best buddies, I wasn't part of the inner sanctum of the... I wasn't part of the closest political advisors in the office. But I think I had I loved working for him. I had an excellent relationship with him, and I feel as though when, as I say, you know, when we worked together on a speech, it was just an excellent relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the mechanics, I suppose I should say the mechanics. I mean, you know, he would occasionally rewrite. He wanted to have argument that was sophisticated, nuanced. He would. I wrote about this in. I later wrote a book about working for Hawke, or about Hawke's prime ministership, and I referred to his sense of the paradox, which I won't go into now. But it's but the paradox was a typical Hawke sentence, quite complex in structure, and universal in its meaning. Consisting of a number of different components, which each of which he could elaborate if called upon to do, but which together he summarized, and there were many occasions, and the paradox is just one of these structures, if you like, where that was what we were climbing towards. So yes, there was component of argument, but he really. The way he elevated it was to elevate to these articulate, detailed, nuanced, can I say, statesman-like assessments of you know, whatever the subject matter. And, you know, it could be the total global situation or the, more typically, the structure and nature and position of his government. But he was never one for a cheap shot or a quick line. He didn't... I mean, contemporary politics is all about the line of the day. I don't think Hawke was into the line of the day at all. He was more consistent and much more consistent. He had his own worldview before he came to Parliament, which he, in many ways... well, stuck to, obviously implemented, modified as he went through. And so writing those and so endeavouring to capture those on paper for him to articulate in public was, I found, a richly rewarding job, enormously difficult, as I say. Sometimes you got it absolutely right and he was happy with it. Sometimes you had to, you know, rewrite. But it was... but anyway, he was excellent to work for. Never lost his temper.
I've heard the term, or I've seen the term also in one of the books you wrote, Hawke speak. What exactly was that?
Well, actually, I used one before inadvertently. When I said in place, I think I said Graham was in place. And I just thought, that's a Hawkeism. He didn't implement policies, or certainly the contemporary word is delivery. Well, he had policies that were in place. Oh, Hawke speak, reconciliation, recovery, reconstruction. The three R's, or the four P's, and God knows what the four P's were. His reliance on, as I say, he wanted evidence, and he would rely on, for example, the school's retention rate. Which, when we came to office, quote unquote, was 30%, I think, of school students continuing through to year 12, and under the Hawke government education policies, it increased to 60% or 2/3 or something like that. Now, retention rate is not how school parents would refer to the fact of their children finishing school. They would talk about the kids finish school, or they've left early, or they only did their leaving certificate. And certainly not how students refer to it. And it's not actually how most people refer to it. But for Hawke, it was the retention rate. So this is his. So by Hawke speak, you know, there was a degree of policy. Somewhat impersonal language, somewhat technical or technocrat language. He was a bit of a policy wonk in that regard. But he didn't shy away from that. You know, everybody would say, can't we use some other phrase than retention rate? But he would insist on, he would not insist, but he would use retention rate as a important building block in this overall argument that he's putting together about the success and effectiveness and importance of his government's policies. And, you know, you just have to go with it. The retention rate was part of it. He would cite international authorities that perhaps many people hadn't heard of. I remember the head of the IMF or something like that became a, you know, commonplace of Australian political dialogue because Hawke had introduced this person, this French person, as, you know, who'd made some comments about the success of the Australian economy. So, you know, I mean, he would grapple with, he would grab and assemble facts from all sorts. He would put them through his policy mind, and they would come out in ways that certainly sometimes they were, you know, as I say, they're not the language of the of individual voters or citizens, but he didn't mind that.
Mm. Did Hawke in his speeches aim to for set targets, for example, or was he more in terms of aspirational goals?
Set targets?
I'm thinking of one particular speech that he gave in 1987, which you may have been involved with.
Sorry.
Australian child will be living in poverty by 1990, I think, if I remember correctly.
Well, Edward, you need to quote that statement in full, you see.
But that was those are the words that everyone remembers.
Yeah, now. Sadly. Okay, 1987 policy speech. I'd been in the office for a year. I mean, I've written, I was certainly involved in that speech, but it had many hands on it. I don't know how it came to be worded in the speaking text in that way. I simply don't know. I can't remember. And as I say, you know, these speeches, I mean, there are just so many drafts that get produced. But the situation was that the supporting policy documents, so the policy speech as delivered is backed up by an extensive set of policy documents, and that included the important qualifier, no child will need to live in poverty. Why won't they need to live in poverty? It was because their parents will be receiving this new family allowance supplement that was being introduced, which was being made as an election promise. I presume that in the drafting process, as the policy speech has to, you know, get drafted and, you know, refined for presentation purposes, that phrase, no child will need to live in poverty, got boiled down to no child will live in poverty or will be living in poverty, forget which. But even there, the speech said, and so we set ourselves this goal, colon, no child will live in poverty. So, I mean, if you have the whole sentence, it is certainly stated as a goal, as a target. And, you know, it was said with the support of these documents, which were showing the new levels of, you know, family assistance payment, mm-hmm. would, in fact, lift families out of the, what was then we called the Henderson poverty, would above the Henderson poverty line. So it was a perfectly legitimate thing to say. The tragedy of the whole thing was that the policy itself was brilliant and actually did what we said it would. No child needed to live in poverty because their parents were receiving this funding. So, look, that's, you know, it was very unfortunate. By the time 1990 came around, the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence ran this, I thought, just cheap campaign that Peter Hollingworth was behind, where, you know, they sent postcards to people saying, you know, this, here's a child who's still living in poverty, you know, as though the government had in some way failed to, like, I mean, if the program hadn't been proceeded with, sure, attack the government. The program had been fully proceeded with, you know, it was fully implemented. The family assistance supplement was out there. And yet here was the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, one of the great welfare organisations of our country, one of which I had personally, because of my father's background, had a lot of time for. And it was just, you know, cheap. I thought to attack Hawke for this policy when we for this what was presented as a promise, when it was a you know expressed as a policy goal.
The back a bit to thinking more a bit about Hawke. How did you would you describe his personality and character, and suppose even importantly his ability to communicate?
Oh well, I mean, it was well, externally, you know, when he was out in the people, it just used to amaze me. You know, he used to sparkle. And I know this has been said before, the love affair with the Australian people and so forth, but he genuinely would. It was like they were a big battery and he could plug into them and charge himself up. You know, he loved being out there and he sparkled. He radiated joy. People liked being with him. As I say, one of the great privileges of a staff job is that you don't just see that external face, you see the internal face. And so, you know, I'll say it again, but I mean, to sit on the other side of his desk with him, to see him working, this is not the Bob Hawke, you know, love affair of the Australian people. This is the Bob Hawke, the Rhodes Scholar, I guess, the policy guy, you know, the person who is very... burdened by office, putting in enormous hours, etc. You know, so you see that side of it as well. Look, as a man, I was not into golf and I was not into horse racing. So you know, and I've already said I wasn't part of his kind of closest circle. Didn't have to be. Even so, I mean, he was an enormously entertaining sometimes person. I can remember having to take some speech around to him at the lodge, and he was, you know, literally sunbaking in the Speedos by the pool, you know, covered with suntan cream and stuff like that. It must have been a Saturday morning because he was making his race call, you know, he would call around to sort out his tips and so forth. So he's sitting out there with the paper in the sun. But, you know, as soon as there's work there, it's kind of like instant change and he's fully focused. I forget what the speech was, but, you know, just immediately getting into the nitty-gritty of what this was about and dealing with the work before him, and then it'd be over and then he'd relax again, you know. So amazing, amazing engine for work. Just a stunt, you know. Never failing.
Did you notice any sort of change in him in these sort of respects over the years that you worked with him? I'm thinking that in terms of his own love affair with the people was regarded that that was as strong as ever on his side, but it didn't work. It wasn't the people did not feel quite the same way about him as years went by, and he became less popular with the ordinary voters, according to the surveys that I've
seen. Well, he still won four elections, you know, and and the later ones were harder to win, both 87 and 90. Mm. Well, I mean, any election is hard to win, but I don't think, and I wasn't there for 84 or 83, obviously, but certainly the ones that I saw him, you know, campaigning, he was, you know, there was no evidence of that tailing off, you know, of popularity. Look, maybe citizens get tired of their leaders, you know, no doubt, no doubt they do. So there must have been some change. I didn't really see that. You know, I think he certainly never lost his capacity to go out there. and his faith, you know, that if he went out there, he'd be able to charge up.
Talk about a bit more about some of the major speeches that you were in, I believe you were involved in, which had to do with Hawke's role, I suppose, as an international negotiator and mediator and in that scene, and his relationship. Could you talk a bit about his relationship with, if I can use the terms, Washington, Jerusalem, Moscow, and Beijing, which were places which I understand he visited and you were involved in certainly some of those trips yourself?
Sure. I never got to Beijing, but certainly the others. Well, that was the chapter heading from my book, and they were, the four big centres of international focus for him. Obviously, not London. He just wasn't particularly interested in the British Labour Party, or, from my observation, Britain. You know, certainly compared to Australia's future, it was Washington. And he invested a great deal of time and effort and all of the... this has been extensively reported, I know, about his good relationship with Reagan, his excellent relationship with George Shultz, both on and off the golf course. You know, the centrality of the US alliance to Australia's security in a changing world. So Washington, certainly. Jerusalem, Hawke's long commitment to the Jewish people and to the existence of an Israeli state, well known. And he made, and I went on that trip, visit to the Middle East, including to Israel, which I think for him was a very powerful and important event. And I'll also say, just while we're on it, when we went to Moscow as well, perhaps the emotional high point of the Moscow visit was not the lengthy and kind of astonishing discussion that he apparently had with Gorbachev about the whole perestroika movement that was then underway in Russia, but after that was Hawke's successful negotiation for the release of the refuseniks, as they were called, the Russian Jews who were just desperately seeking to be let out and go to Israel. And Hawke was able to successfully, well, who knows what basis the decision was made on. The Russians are such cynical bastards, but anyway, they let some more out while Hawke was there as a result of his personal representations. And that was this was a person, Hawke was a person for whom international politics often boiled down to personal relationships, a la Shultz. But in the case of Israel, it was a very deeply emotional one. I've never understood why, to be perfectly honest. I know, well, we all share a commitment to the creation of the State of Israel and the historical necessity for that to have been achieved and for it to survive. But for Hawke, it was a very emotional attachment. So Washington, Jerusalem, well, Beijing, you know, was, the future of the Australian economy. And again, you know, he would just assiduously build these personal relations. He loved the international statesman role. And I don't say that in any meretricious way. He was good at it. You know, he actually believed, and there's lots of evidence to suggest that it's true, that the close relationships that he had with these guys actually did achieve stuff. He could get very good dialogue going. So, yes, we all of these international trips were accompanied by big speeches. Here it wasn't so much our department that was involved in drafting, but obviously Foreign Affairs was involved in a lot of input into them. You know, there'd be a state banquet, you know, where you have to summarise the whole relationship between Australia and Russia or Ireland or Canada. Thailand or whatever. But there would also be an economic speech to a business group, and they were. I mean, the international travel was exhilarating, exhausting. I mean, you tend to work around the clock. Probably the biggest that I look back on was in South Korea, where he made the speech but certainly in South Korea, after meeting the South Korean president, they actually, this is an example of where the personal relationship and the personal chemistry really paid off, because they hit it off very well and pretty well decided between them, as I understand it, that it was time to take the concept of Asia-Pacific economic cooperation to a new level. And so we worked all night to put this in words for a speech which he was making the following day, at which he basically announced an initiative to build such an organization. This is the roots of APEC. There was a lot of departmental resistance. Oh, Prime Minister, we think, blah, blah, blah. He just wouldn't take any of that crap. He wanted to do this. He saw the opportunity and did it. But we had to make the speech. So, I don't know, it was 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that. It was just one of those great nights, and it worked well.
For speeches you did on these sort of trips, did the government departments rather than yourself and Graham have a major input into the speech writing and into the speech content?
Well, I guess I misspoke before. We didn't have any access to other departments. We had access to prime ministers, but they had access to other departments. And so the foreign policy speeches certainly had a lot of input from DFAT. And the international trips, typically Hawke was accompanied not just by Michael Codd, the Secretary of PM&C, but, it was Stuart Harris for a while, who was the Secretary of DFAT. They were very significant players in the... John Bowen, I should say, the political advisor, Hawke's foreign policy advisor, the remarkable and magnificent John Bowen, was just so across all of this. So, nothing that came from the department was not better after it had been over John Bowen's desk as a result of going across his desk, because he could always highlight, emphasize, clarify, express, this masses of complex policy stuff into important and relevant. So John Bowen was critical in that whole process.
And what's your role still, that of being effectively the coordinator, the one who puts it all together?
Yeah.
And that's why you travel with the Prime Minister and also why you would work right through the night to have the things...
Sure, somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to pull it all together, and I'm certainly not writing these things, from scratch. I'm assembling inputs from departments, from Hawke's staff advisors, from the press office, from Hawke himself, and I'm assembling all of those and putting a structure to it and good language around it. By assembling, that's not a kind of Lego operation. That's more like a Magimix operation. I don't know, but it requires you can tell a bad speech because you can see all of the joins, and I'd never let that happen. You have to. So you're re-expressing. By assembling, you're re-expressing and putting into language and putting into language that you think is appropriate for Hawke, but also getting the Hawke perspective. I mean, I say this with understanding, but nobody who drafted stuff for Hawke, I mean, Graham gets this perfectly, Graham Freudenberg. But he's the Prime Minister, for God's sake. He doesn't express things like that. He expresses things like this. He's at the centre of things. And So when I say, you know, you're dealing with all of this input, but you have to re-express it and, as I say, get that perspective, that prime ministerial, that Bob Hawke perspective onto it.
Did Graham Frydenberg travel with you on these trips, or were you the only?
Oh, we would wax. So sometimes he would go, sometimes I would go. In 1989, in June of 1989, there was a visit proposed to, I forget where, England and Europe and somewhere. And on the 16th of June 1989, my son was born. And departure day was probably the 17th of June. So needless to say, I called in to Sandy Holway and said, guess what? Safe arrival at Woden Valley Hospital. Sandy, I guess I can get myself organised for the... But he said, don't. So Graham was... I'm not saying this news came as any surprise. He was packed and ready. And so he went off on that trip and loved it. It was a great trip, apparently. Well, Europe, why not? Refers very favourably to my son, Chris, in his book for having permitted that trip. So, yeah, you wouldn't have two speechwriters on the trip. Mm. You'd have one. And so we would wax. Graham went to Gallipoli for the 90th anniversary. I didn't do that one. And that was a great event. I did the Middle East, you know, so it was a... I did the US bicentenary, which was a great one. Now, that speech to Congress, I mean, that's a classic example. There were so many hands on that. It was a great group effort. I could hardly claim authorship of that one. That was a very much a collective effort.
Mm. Given the importance that Hawke placed on relationships with, a large looming friends like Washington and Jerusalem and Beijing and India as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've sort of left with an impression that did he place more emphasis, these more important speeches and more important events for him than were, let's say, domestic politics in Australia?
Oh, no, I don't think you'd say that, no. No, but certainly when you're travelling, they are extremely important. Mm. You're right about India. We made a visit to New Delhi. When Rajiv Gandhi was Prime Minister, one of the few people I've met who radiated an aura, remarkable fellow Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi, and Hawke had a very good relationship with him. We delivered a Indira Gandhi memorial lecture, which was delivered to this vast bloody audience of, you know, the great and the good in Delhi that had come along to here. And I mean, you can't not do that without, you know, 110% effort, you know, by Hawke to express the Australia-India relationship, to say something decent about Indira Gandhi, whose speech, you know, to contemporise, but also, you know, to make it Australian as well. So you would absolutely, you know, fully engage at that moment. But no, you certainly wouldn't say that was more important than a domestic policy speech. It's just that, you know, when you go overseas, you've got to go overseas. The domestic policy ones, the most important speeches were the policy speeches, without any doubt, certainly measured by the number of, you know, people involved and the coverage they received and, you know, the complexity of the content.
Hmm. Can you talk a bit more detail what it was like to accompany the Prime Minister on overseas trips during this period of time? I think you have seen some reference to Moscow. That was a fairly had some interesting aspect to it. You went to the Kremlin, I believe, and had.
Yep.
There's a picture of you somewhere. It's in the background. Sitting in and listening discussion between the Russians and the Australian delegation.
Right. Well, I think the picture. Look, these overseas trips, they were highly. They were very exciting. They were somewhat artificial. They were planned within an inch of themselves. You'd get these little white books with everybody's name and, you know, itineraries and car numbers. You know, you'd travel in, you know, this car in the convoy and so forth, and you'd be whisked around these foreign capitals. I remember going through Agra in India, and at a crossroads there was, you know, there could have been 2 million people waiting at the crossroads for the Australian party to get through. You know, it was so you're travelling in the VIP. You know, there's the journalist down the back, and up the front we just worked as an office. I mean, there were, you know, not laptops, there were word processors set up, and, you know, the ongoing work continues. The trip to Russia was good. I hated Russia because I hated the Russians, and I thought they were, you know, just such a oppressive society.
So perestroika didn't
reach. Oh, well, it was happening, thank God. But I saw people, there was a Pasternak book of poetry which was being released as an example of glasnost, no doubt. And there were queues of Muscovites literally around the block waiting to get into this bookshop. And we were walking past, you know, on the street. And